From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If war is hell, this last week was proof again. An American beheaded, a shaming torrent of images of American soldiers abusing Iraqi detainees. A nation trying to make sense of what it has seen, a world looking at the United States with bewilderment. We need a gut check. We'll talk tonight with Weekly Standard editor William Crystal, an intellectual architect of the war, with Ian Lustig, a deep critic of the war, and with you tonight on Point, reassessing Iraq and America's standing in the world. We begin in Baghdad, where there was fierce fighting today around one of the holiest sites in Shiite Islam. Yuhi Driesen is a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. He's been writing about the quiet steps U.S. officials have been taking to ensure American influence in Iraq after the June 30th handover of formal sovereignty. I asked him what steps the U.S. has taken.
The United States, post-June 30th, will have two or three powerful levers. The first is that there will be an enormous American military presence, which will not only command American troops, but will also command a new Iraqi army. So Iraq's new army will be subservient to the U.S. The second is that by having an embassy overseeing $18 billion of construction, a lot of what Iraq looks like will also be determined by the U.S. And the third thing, and this is the part that's gotten the least attention in some ways, is that there will be American-appointed officials, some American, some Iraqi, inside of every single Iraqi ministry, which means that any ministerial decision will have to be made with, minimally, with the tacit approval of the United States.
Give us a sense of how that last piece might work. You've written, as you say, that the new Iraqi government will have little control over its armed forces. It will not have the ability to make or change laws. And it will be unable to make major decisions within specific ministries without tacit U.S. approval. You've given an example here from the Ministry of Communications in Haider al-Abadi. Can you share that example with us?
Sure. The Ministry of Communications had quite a bit of power to do things that range from licensing cell phone companies, which had become very popular in Baghdad, to licensing television stations and other types of communications companies. All of those powers have been taken away from the ministry and will instead be given to a 9-person commission. The interesting thing about the commission is that it will be entirely independent. There will be no one from the ministry sitting on it. It won't answer to the ministry or to the new government, which means, practically speaking, that the power to determine how a very important part of the Iraqi economy develops, communications, telephones, television, will reside in a commission appointed by the U.S. that will have no direct link at all to the Iraqi government itself.
And how did the head of Iraq's Ministry of Communications learn about this commission?
He learned about it essentially when a reporter called him for comment. It had been signed into law by Ambassador Bremer in late March. As he tells it, and has been confirmed as well by the CPA, no one from the CPA had told him it had been formally signed into law. He sort of knew it was in discussion, but didn't know how advanced those discussions were. A reporter called him and said, essentially, how do you feel to have lost all of your power? And that was how we discovered that, in fact, he had lost all of his power.
And is this the same right across Iraqi ministries?
The commission structure itself exists only in a couple of ministries. What is the same is that there will be American advisors who, in some cases in the past, have fought with the ministers about who could actually make a decision, the minister or them. There will be American advisors in every ministry. And there will also be American auditors in the industry. These auditors will be Iraqi, but they'll have extraordinary power within the ministries. And the fear a lot of ministers have expressed is that no minister will want to take a decision the U.S. won't approve of for fear of having these very powerful auditors inside their ministry swoop in and open up an investigation into them or their staff.
Yuhi, what will be the actual structure of power at the top of the Iraqi government? Paul Bremer presumably will be stepping down, even leaving Baghdad. We don't know yet who will be the head of the new Iraqi government. What is that top likely to look like, and how will it intersect with what American authority?
You're right. Ambassador Bremer will certainly have the image of getting onto a plane on June 30th and waving from the steps of the plane and flying away. They have not yet said who exactly will be the prime minister, who will have most day-to-day power. There will also be a largely ceremonial president and the two vice presidents. They chose that number so that they could try to have at least one member, and in the case of the Shia, two members from each of Iraq's ethnic groups. They'll be the sort of heads of the Iraqi government. They'll be, in some ways, subservient to, effectively, John Negroponte, who will be the head of this extraordinarily large embassy, the largest embassy, as best as anyone could tell, that's ever been created anywhere on the planet, as well as the American military commander, General Sanchez, other generals that answer to him, since those generals will control Iraq's armed forces.
Yuki, from what you've seen then, does the word sovereignty properly apply to the situation that Iraqi officials will face post-June 30th?
It's an interesting question, because depending on the Iraqis you speak to, some Iraqis will say, it doesn't matter what happens on June 30th, it doesn't matter what the Americans do, because Iraq has always been a sovereign state and will always be a sovereign state, regardless of who controls it. On the other hand, using a commonly accepted definition of a sovereign state, that being a state that can control its borders, control its army, control the ability to make laws, by that definition, what takes power on June 30th will be fairly far away from being a sovereign state.
And Yoki, looking at today's news, I want to ask you just quickly about the fighting today in Karbala and Najaf near the holiest of Shiite shrines there. We're reading reports that holes have been blown in the dome of the shrine of Imam Ali, one of the most sacred sites of Shiite Muslims, that American tanks are in the big cemetery there, that another mosque has been taken. How is this being received by Iraqis? As a kind of desecration, or U.S. troops doing what has to be done to pacify Muqtada al-Sadr's militia?
Najaf is a very interesting and very explosive case. There certainly is extraordinarily deep rage against Muqtada al-Sadr for having brought his militia into Najaf, and by doing so, turning it into a combat zone. That said, American credibility within Iraq right now, particularly involving the military, is at an all-time low because of the abuses at Abu Ghraib. If there is, in fact, damage to the mosque, which has been reported, but some of the reports have appeared somewhat sketchy, but if there is damage to the mosque done by an American tank or an American military, that would be catastrophic, because for the Shias, there is nothing holier. And to have foreign troops in the city is bad enough. To have those foreign troops also damaging the shrine could very easily lead to a very wide Shiite uprising across the country.
Yoki Driessen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Yoki Driessen is a correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Baghdad. We are going around the dial tonight on Iraq and America's standing in the world. We'll hear in a moment from conservative thought leader Bill Kristol and later from deep war critic Ian Lustig. But first, we go to Beirut for a regional take on the situation. Rami Khoury is executive editor of the Daily Star in Beirut. He's a Jordanian who knows America and Americans well. I asked him how he sees the U.S. situation in Iraq after this bloody and controversial week.
Well, the U.S. situation in Iraq is very difficult right now, and it's probably going to get more difficult, because if you look back at what's happened, the Abu Ghraib prisoner abuse issue has taken away almost the last dimension of American credibility, or the last possible hope that some people in the Middle East may have had for a constructive outcome of the American presence in Iraq, because most of the other reasons that the U.S. gave for going to Iraq proved false, that Iraq wasn't involved with September 11, there were no weapons of mass destruction, they haven't really used Iraq to spread democracy around the Middle East. So the last hope was, well, maybe the U.S. would be able to help bring about a more stable and peaceful and free Iraq, and that credibility has gone now. I mean, people now look at the U.S. as just another terrible occupying power doing things that were just as bad as Saddam Hussein was doing. So I think the consequences are really very significant, but will probably not become clear for some time.
Rami, let me ask you, George Bush, President Bush, and others in the American government have said that they will demonstrate the transparency and the justice of the American system by putting these soldiers who abused prisoners in Abu Ghraib on trial publicly and quickly. How much difference do you think those trials will make to Iraqi, to Arab observers of what happened at Abu Ghraib?
They'll make a little bit of difference to some people, but they won't make a lot of difference, because this is not about show and tell about American civics. This is not about the Americans proving themselves to be a good democracy. We know that the American system at home is a democratic system and relatively fair to all of its citizens. But the approach that President Bush is using and Rumsfeld and others, saying that the U.S. is going to show the Iraqis and the Arabs how the U.S. deals with these issues, that's totally besides the point. I mean, it's also quite insulting to most people in this region. The problem is at one narrow level, that you had this use of prisoners by a relatively small number of people, perhaps. There seems to be abuse in other places where the Americans and Brits possibly have jurisdiction. But the bigger problem is the whole adventure of 150,000 American troops coming to Iraq, overthrowing the government, changing the constitution, telling the Iraqis how they should run their future country. And this whole thing is a macro problem is really what I think angers most people, and the prisoner abuse is just seen to be a manifestation of this by most people in this region.
Rami, let me ask you, you know America well, you've spent plenty of time there, you no doubt have plenty of American friends. You're not an unsympathetic observer by any means of the United States, as to the extent that I know you. When you sit back and look at this whole saga now, what conclusions are you taking from it?
Well, you're right to say that I am. I know America well, and I have great respect for it. And I envy many of the things that define American governance and American political and public values and personal values. It's a tremendous country, and I wish many of the American values were ones that we shared, especially in democracy and pluralism and things like that. But the main lesson that I take is that most of these values are not manifested overseas in America's foreign policy. That's the real problem. The real problem is that the U.S. is very democratic at home, and it treats its people relatively well. It has a good democratic system. But when it goes overseas, it takes its army, it overthrows regimes, it makes false claims. And this is the real problem, as I see it. And the Iraqi adventure has made this much worse. It has made America's credibility and standing in the world much worse. And it's not just the Arab Islamic world, it's the whole world, if you look at Europe and China and other places. So I think there's a huge problem that the United States and its people have to deal with, a huge problem in terms of how American values are transported overseas.
So at this point, Rami Khoury, in a nutshell, and it's hard advice to give, but if the United States wants to tamp down Islamist terrorism and encourage democracy in the Middle East, what should it do, in your view?
I think it should do several things. First of all, be consistent in its policy. If it's really serious about promoting democracy, it can do that tomorrow. It can do it tonight. It can do it in the next 30 minutes in all of the countries where it already has tremendous impact, in Egypt, in Jordan, in Morocco, in Saudi Arabia, in the Gulf. It doesn't have to send an army and overthrow a regime in Iraq to spread democracy. It can spread democracy right now as we speak by adopting more clear and consistent policies. So that's one thing. The second thing is that I think the United States should make sure that it is promoting in its foreign policy the same values that it preaches. In other words, it puts its money where its mouth is. It acts in a democratic way and not in an autocratic way. The way it's acting in Iraq is unacceptable to the world. It's unacceptable to most people in the Middle East. It's autocratic, it's predatory, it's militaristic, it's unilateralist. And these are things that are completely against the values of American democracy and freedom and consensus and participatory governance. So consistency in American policy is an important thing that we would recommend. Being true to your words is another thing. And working together, not being the determinant of how the world should be, working with the world, working with the Arab people. Nobody will ask the United States to come and spread democracy around this region. I mean, democracy is a great thing, and I'd love it if it was spread throughout the region. But nobody asked or mandated the United States to do this, and certainly not to do it through the instrument of the United States Armed Forces. So the United States should work with the people in this region and come up with a joint program where we all agree on what we're doing and implement it together, and that would be fine.
Advice from a friend, Rami Khoury, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Rami Khoury is executive editor of the Daily Star. He spoke with me today from Beirut. We are talking tonight at the end of a disturbing week about the conflict in Iraq and America's shaken standing in the world. We'll hear after the break from William Kristol, one of the primary intellectual architects of the war in Iraq. We will hear from Ian Lustig, a deep critic of the war in Iraq. We look forward to hearing from you as well. Where are we now? In Iraq, in the world, at home. Where does America's moral authority stand tonight? And after all the gruesome photos, the beheading, the blame game and avoidance, where do you stand tonight between hope and despair? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight at the end of a disturbing week in Iraq about the conflict there and America's standing in the world. William Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard in Washington, is one of the country's most influential conservative thinkers, along with Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, former Pentagon official Richard Perle, and other influential neoconservatives. He spent years pushing for regime change in Iraq. Washington Post columnist Richard Cohen once dubbed the conflict there Kristol's War. Bill Kristol is still holding out hope for the war effort, but he's worried. He spoke with me earlier from Washington. Bill Kristol, when you look out on Iraq now, if there's not some dramatic action taken in some new direction by the administration, can failure be avoided in Iraq?
It can be. It would be more easily avoided if the administration took a bunch of actions, some moderately dramatic, some just, I think, in the direction of greater competence in waging the war, in reconstructing the country, and managing the political process. But I think we are on something of a knife edge now, and this was a winnable effort. If you make a lot of little mistakes, no one of them can be, you can't blame any one of them perhaps for derailing the effort, but they do accumulate, and they have accumulated to a point where we're at considerable risk now, I think.
Bill Kristol, you're writing that current Washington wisdom is that the only way out now is to figure out a way to extricate the U.S. and get going. You say this is far too pessimistic. At the same time, you say that the Bush administration seems not to recognize how widespread and how bipartisan is the view that Iraq is already lost or on the verge of being lost. Describe that Washington spectrum of views, bipartisan views, that you're referring to there.
The widespread view, which I think is wrong, but it is widespread, and therefore it has a real effect of its own on American public opinion, is that it's probably hopeless. We're not quite there yet, but we're getting to a situation where we have to acknowledge defeat, at least privately, and find a way out. And the question is extricating ourselves with the least damage to ourselves and to the Iraqis and to our world position. I think that's the basic private view of almost every Democrat I've talked to and to a surprising number of Republicans. Now, I think that can be beat back by actually changing some policies and improving things on the ground, and also by pointing out that when you actually think through what a gradual and gracefully handled loss looks like in terms of its consequences in the real world, it's pretty horrifying. But the administration first has to realize that they're at risk of losing and at risk of being perceived to be losing, and they need to snap out of their sort of defensive crouch. They need to make some changes, I think, in policy, send more troops, move the elections closer, change the dynamic on the ground in various ways. And also, in terms of the rhetoric here, show that they realize they made some mistakes. One reason Bush's numbers have gone down in the polls is that people think, well, gee, he made these mistakes, and a lot of these mistakes are understandable. It's a tough thing to run a war, 10,000 miles away, and doing something we're not used to doing, occupying a country, trying to prepare it for democracy, et cetera. But you're going to make mistakes, but then acknowledge the mistakes and correct them. And I think people have lost confidence in the administration's ability to do that.
A number of conservatives have been speaking out on exactly that front recently. David Brooks is saying it's been a crushingly depressing period, especially for people who support the war in Iraq. George Will, of course, is saying the administration cannot be trusted to govern if it cannot be counted on to think and having thought to have second thoughts. And your frequent co-author, Robert Kagan, saying all but the most blindly devoted Bush supporters can see the Bush administration officials have no clue about what to do in Iraq tomorrow, much less a month from now. What's the primary sort of gripe here from the conservative side, that something is calcified, that there's not active enough thinking going on inside the White House now?
Well, the primary gripe is just that for a year there have been obvious failures in the post-war planning and the post-war execution. None of us is perfect. I'm sure we've made mistakes in our analysis, too, but we've called attention to these failures. They weren't very hard to see. The failure to have enough troops right at the beginning, to stop the looting, to get the reconstruction going fast enough. The failure, I think, to crush the insurgency early on when we could have crushed it. And then the recent retreats in Fallujah, especially, which I think have been very damaging. All these things, I think, have accumulated into creating a serious problem for the administration. Now, I'm not as pessimistic as some of my friends in the conservative world. I think they probably thought it was going to be easier than I did, and some of them, and maybe haven't been around quite as long as I have in the case of someone like David Brooks and hasn't been through as many ups and downs. And I think we can win this, and I think we will, actually, if you ask me to bet. But I'm just trying to get the administration to wake up to the problem and make the changes necessary to win it. More troops, faster elections, much tougher attitude, I think, towards the insurgents, especially those who have killed Americans and the like.
Your number one suggestion for the administration is that elections be moved up from next January to this fall, September, and you say it will take a good deal larger volume of American troops in Iraq to do that. What's your hope for that move, if that should happen?
I think if you have elections sooner rather than later, you don't have some long interim government that has no legitimacy that either we put in place or the UN's put in place, which allows lots of people to say we're fighting for Iraqi freedom. If we're sponsoring elections, then all the violence is anti-democratic violence. It's not simply anti-American occupation violence. And we've been through this in Central America and El Salvador. It was a mess. The elections weren't perfect. There were death squads on both sides. Still, the people of El Salvador felt they were voting for their own representatives, for their own rulers, and we were sort of helping them get there. And I think that has to be the attitude in Iraq. I think it is the truth of what we're trying to do in Iraq, but we've let the process spread out so long that for waverers there on the ground, it can look a little bit more like an occupation, and the nationalists can sort of rally people against us. I think that's the second most important thing we have to do. The most important thing we have to do is win the war. I mean, war is war. To win a war, you kill your enemies. We have backed off from fighting the war in the last 5-6 weeks as vigorously as I think we should be fighting it. And I think that actually is the fundamental key. And Fallujah was a very worrisome, I think, prospect, where we had these people who had killed Americans, who were lots of the jihadists were there. We had the town surrounded. We were letting the civilians out. We were getting ready to go in. And for reasons no one quite understands, the Marines who were ready to go were called off. And we then had this spectacle of this Ba'athist general coming in for 2 days. And then he was called off, remember, and mm-hmm. some other general in there. Mm-hmm. But it just is a very dangerous sign of weakness. So win the war, move up the elections, send more troops. You know, I think we can win this. It's not going to be easy, but people, I think, are tolerant of difficulty and of casualties. They just want to be sure that there's a real strategy for victory.
On the win, the war front, it appeared, and I don't know, but it appeared that U.S. generals decided that to go in more violently, more devastatingly into Fallujah, to flatten Fallujah, would be in itself a kind of Pyrrhic victory that might be more costly in terms of Iraqi public opinion in turning Iraqis against the U.S. than it would be in defeating the insurgents were there. You think they're wrong on that? Or, for example, today in Najaf, where these very sacred Shiite shrines are taking fire, from whom is not quite clear, but they're being damaged in the fighting. Are you so confident that bringing down the heavy fist would be more effective in winning the war than it would be destructive in turning public opinion against the U.S.?
Well, in Fallujah, I'm confident, yes. We have to crush the Sunni Ba'athist insurgency. There's no issue of winning hearts and minds there, in my view. I don't believe that most of the generals believe that. I think that was a political decision, but it's obviously a political judgment about public opinion. It's not a military judgment, and I don't buy it. I think in the South, with the Shias, a much more complicated situation, and I'm more open to the notion that we're doing the right thing there, which is letting the Shia rally against Sadr, which they're doing pretty well. Ultimately, we cannot lose the Shia. They are the majority, and they have been our allies. They were persecuted by Saddam. They behaved quite responsibly. I think we're handling maybe that situation in Najaf and Karbala pretty well, a combination of pressure on Sadr, but also not just coming in with in a very heavy way into these holy cities for the Shia. But in Fallujah, I think we're dealing with gangsters who killed Americans, and the idea that we sort of back off and let a former Saddam loyalists take over is extremely damaging, I think. And I think if the swing public opinion in Iraq wants to be reassured that we're going to crush the people who kept them under their heel for 35 years and give them a chance to live. Now, if they're not going to crush those people, then they're going to start making their own deals. If we're not going to crush those people, they're going to have to make their own deals. And that's when the dangerous dynamic begins, I think.
Bill Kristol, on another front, how are you processing these deeply disturbing images of American soldiers abusing Iraqi detainees, torturing is the word some have used? How serious the damage to U.S. credibility, integrity, standing, moral standing around the world?
I don't buy it. I'm not going to be totally candid here and shock your listeners. You know, if it was a bad thing, they should be disciplined. People who were responsible higher up, who should have known about it, there was obviously a failure of command and control, should be disciplined and are being disciplined. There's never been a war fought in human history where some prison guard somewhere didn't abuse some detainees. There have been a heck of a lot worse forms of abuse, if I could be totally candid. And I think my attitude towards it is I process it. It's unfortunate. I'm for very strict military discipline, so I'm unhappy about it, because I think you really need to have a military that doesn't do this kind of thing. And they need to be disciplined. The president's apologized to the Iraqis, and that's it. We don't need to apologize to the whole Arab world. This doesn't discredit the idea that Arab governments, who routinely, as a matter of policy, torture prisoners in ways infinitely worse than anything these idiots did. The idea that, you know, we should be worried, these Arab governments might really be indignant, or Arab people who, you know, if they don't know what happens in their own countries, I don't frankly take that seriously.
Leave aside your assessment for a moment of the relative weight of what went on there. What about simply the cost to U.S. interest and U.S. standing of those images themselves?
I wish the images hadn't come out. It's terrible that those defense attorneys put them out, incidentally. I mean, these images are themselves against the Geneva Convention. And I'm against releasing the rest of the photos for that reason. It does no good, and it does only damage to us. But I don't know. What is the cost? I'm curious to know. To serious people, I mean, can we be grown up about this and not treat the whole world as if they're eight-year-olds? Do serious people around the world know that if you have 250,000 soldiers in the theater, bad things don't happen? Do serious people think this is the policy of the U.S. government to torture prisoners? I don't think so. So I'm very dubious that it makes such a big impression, frankly. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they're just all these good-hearted people out there who otherwise like the U.S., and they see some idiots whose misdeeds we know about because of a U.S. Army investigation, who are right now being court-martialed, and they think, gee, this is somehow U.S. policy. But I just can't believe it. Maybe I'm wrong.
Let me ask you, Bill, your thinking was very influential in taking the country toward this war with Iraq. You've outlined enough mistakes you think have been made, and many of the administration would concede those as well, and enough troops and how they've gone about the war in certain dimensions. But has the course of this conflict led you, as an intellectual architect here, to rethink any of your fundamental premises about how the United States ought to be wielding its power in the 21st century?
No, I mean, I'm disappointed in the Bush administration, and I suppose I could still be convinced that this administration just wasn't up to doing the job. But I also would say, then, what's the alternative? I mean, no one seriously thinks we can just go on and say, okay, fine, leave the Arab world alone. We're not going to make any effort to change things. Saddam, we could have just, I guess the argument would be we could have left him there, though I don't quite buy that, since I think he would have rearmed with the oil money that would have come from the sanctions being off. I don't think we had much choice, and God knows, I wish we were doing it more competently, rather than less competently. But honestly, I know a lot of my colleagues are having anguished second thoughts, and maybe it shows a certain lack of depth in my soul, but I can't really say that I am. I'm very angry that we're not fighting the war more effectively, but I'm not really having any fundamental second thoughts. Maybe I will in 2 years if I'm proven totally wrong, if the Bush administration doesn't fix its course, and if everything turns out terribly. I certainly hope that's not the case.
I guess we all do. Let me ask you lastly, how solid do you think American public support for this Iraq effort is as we talk today?
I think it's been amazingly strong. I mean, I think much to the frustration of many critics of the war, the American public has been quite tolerant, maybe too tolerant, of a lot of missteps by the Bush administration. They continue, until very recently, have said, and still say by considerable numbers, maybe not quite a majority anymore, that, you know, they approve of the war, they don't want to pull out, that sort of thing. And obviously John Kerry himself also says he doesn't want to pull out, and indeed voted for the war. So I actually think the public is not the problem. And I think, to the degree the Bush administration, people are sitting around in the Bush White House thinking, ooh, public opinion means we've got to pull back, they won't tolerate casualties, I just don't buy it. They won't tolerate casualties if it's not, you know, if there's not a prospect of victory, if it's all pointless, if it's just for the sake of getting out more slowly. But I think the American people, certainly having gone to war, want to win the war. I think they have plenty of patience for doing so. They just want to see a sensible and serious strategy and the competent execution of that strategy. So my problem is with, you know, elites who don't like the war, and with the Bush administration, which has done a bad job in too many ways, unfortunately, of fighting it, not with the American people.
But you've written in your column in The Standard this week with Robert Kagan, you write, the administration may not appreciate how close the whole nation is to tipping decisively against the war.
Well, I think they will tip against it in the sense that they think that it now can't be won because it's been run so incompetently. They'll, of course, say, well, why throw good money after bad, but more importantly, why, you know, throw good lives after previous good lives, and they will pull out, and it wouldn't be unreasonable for them to do so. At some point, you can have a good idea, and it might have been the right idea, and if it's just incompetently executed, you have to say enough. I don't think we're quite there. I think the administration needs to be awakened to the fact that people are getting there. You can see that in the polls, obviously. I think it's to the credit of the American people that they've taken so long to get there, if you will. But this is a very dicey moment for the administration and for supporters of the war like me. I mean, this is beyond the point where I can make an articulate or not so articulate argument on your show against someone else who's making an articulate argument on the other side. This is now reality on the ground, and the administration has to show that they can do it, or else all the theories in the world don't count for much.
In a tough reality, Bill Kristol, we thank you for sharing your thoughts with us today.
My pleasure.
William Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard in Washington and one of the primary intellectual architects of the invasion of Iraq, of regime change in Iraq. I'm joined now from Hanover, New Hampshire, by Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good evening, and thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
We wanted to carve this hour out tonight, Jack, and do kind of a pinwheel from Beirut through William Kristol here. We'll talk with Ian Lustick in a moment, a critic of the war effort. It has been an astonishing run of events and revelations in the last week and more. Here we just heard, Jack, one of the core supporters of this war effort expressing doubt on many fronts and determination on others.
Yes, he describes a crisis of competence and confidence, and the two things are related. The administration has been incompetent ever since, Saddam's statue fell down. Almost at every step they have blundered, and that has provoked a tremendous crisis of confidence, even within conservative ranks. And Bill Kristol is a sort of magnetic north of that. So if you have him expressing ambivalence, however faint, you've got a political problem. But let's take a look for a moment at his prescriptions. He says we need to get tougher with the insurgents. Bill's a serious guy, loves the country. He was wrong about Iraq. He's wrong there. If we get tougher with the insurgents, we're going to create more insurgents. If we get tougher with these insurgents, we're going to give hostages all over the world photographs of mosques, hospitals, you name it, blown up. That way lies disaster. Then he says, well, okay, let's move up the elections, have them in October. We need to send more troops, of course, to prevent what? Lines of voters from being blown up. Well, we're not going to do that. Why? Because Mr. Bush wouldn't do that in an election year. He values his election prospects more than he does, the perfect solution in Iraq. In short, his two ideas here just don't seem to be... Well, I don't think there's any future in them. One is disaster, and the other one isn't going to happen. And then, frankly, his judgment and the judgment of his whole movement is every day being called into question by, what did he call it, reality.
Reality, that little matter. Jack, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight at the end of a disturbing and difficult week in Iraq about the conflict there and America's standing in the world. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight at the end of a hard week in Iraq about the conflict there and America's shaken standing in the world. You can join our conversation tonight. Are you prepared for another week like this one, another month, another year? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined now from Lower Merion, Pennsylvania, by Ian Lustick. He's professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, editor of Right-Sizing the State, the Politics of Moving Borders. He's been a guest with us throughout the build up to the war in Iraq, and during the last year, we're delighted to have him back. Good evening, and welcome, Ian Lustick.
Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Here we are at a very tough pass, and we're looking for perspective tonight. We've heard from Rami Khoury in the Middle East. I think you just heard William Kristol speaking with us earlier today from Washington. When you look out on this big scene, Ian Lustick, what moment have we come to as a country in this conflict and beyond it?
Well, you know, oddly enough, when Donald Rumsfeld said we've had a body blow, it evokes something that I think is true for the first time. Something coming out of his mouth actually makes some sense. It's as if the movement that sustained our support for the war was socked in the stomach and lost its breath. It just drains the emotional position out emotional support for the war effort just drains it, so that you don't hear anymore, really, people, even Bill Kristol, arguing the case strongly that we absolutely had to do this, we absolutely will win it, it's the right thing to do. Instead, there's an understanding that it was a disastrous error, and the strongest argument people seem to be making to continue the war is to stay the course. I think that staying the course is in itself, of course, not a course. People who bought WorldCom or Enron stock and stayed the course understood that that was a mistake. I think in the larger context, Bill Kristol's comments raise an interesting question, and that is, well, he said the war is winnable. It's a winnable effort, mm-hmm. which, as I pointed out, that's a far cry from saying, of course we can go in there and win that, and it won't be very costly. And by saying, by being reduced to saying that it is conceivably winnable, he's actually lost the larger conflict that he and his co-author Kagan and the whole project for the new American century had advanced for years, which was that the United States had to revolutionize its foreign policy to become a forward-marching power, a new kind of Roman empire, an hegemonic order to make foreign policy heroic, to build democracies all over the world under our hegemonic rule. And the war in Afghanistan, and specifically the war in Iraq, was supposed to prove that that policy for the next century was sustainable, because we could fight wars quickly, successfully, cheaply, with few troops and without much bother to the American public, certainly not higher taxes. That project, that is the political war that this group of neoconservatives was fighting, that has been defeated. And Americans who have tragically died in Iraq actually didn't die in that sense for nothing, because what they have done is that they've died to prevent many more Americans and others from dying in wars that would have been fought under that slogan for many years to come and now will not be fought.
You think that in this last week, 10 days, 2 weeks, we've seen the high watermark of that ideological view?
I do. In fact, I thought it was already crumbling, but I think that the incident, the prisoner abuse, which in and of themselves are not of such weighty consequence, but the role of emotion in a war situation where the analytics are pretty much against the effort, the emotional component, the ability to feel patriotism, pride, excitement, and confidence by identifying with the war effort was so crucial that this sordid scandal interrupted that, kind of punctured that balloon, and left the supporters with nothing to rely on but actual arguments for the war that they no longer could believe in, whether it had to do with defeating terrorism, since we're producing more terrorists there, or it had to do with weapons of mass destruction, since they were never found, or it has to do with getting rid of Saddam, since getting rid of him didn't appear to have changed much, or it had to do with building a democratic Iraq, which seems as far away as ever.
Ian Lustig, there's a lot more we want to hear from you, but Jack Meadey, first, I'd love to get your response to Ian's dramatic observation that he thinks we have now seen the high watermark of this urge toward what he calls the sort of new Roman Empire, the hegemonic power policy that rode into town on the heels of the Bush administration.
Yeah, I had scratched down on my pencil before we talked to Bill Kristol. The only good feint to come out of this is if his outlook of world control is discredited.
But do you believe that high watermark's been hit, Jack? That's a big statement.
Yes, I do. And I think it was really hit earlier. You know, it hits against, again, reality. You cannot, in the 20th century, rule over other people, even in situations that give you a moral card. We got rid of your hated dictator. Fine. Leave. This has been a century of national, the last century was one of nationalism. And in a strange way, maybe we're creating an Iraqi nationalism. The Iraqis are finding out that their differences are not as great as their unifying gratifying desire, what, by 85%, to see us gone tomorrow. Now, we've been brought to this pass by this vision, which is, was a departure from what had worked in American foreign policy. Containment and deterrence had brought down the evil empire. The crystal on our program before the war started, we can't have containment. It's breaking down. We can't risk containment any longer. We can't deter Saddam. Well, we would have been a heck of a lot better off if we had stayed with it. So I do think that, yes, it could be that neoconservative will pass in American history, is my thought, is my hope, the way isolationists did after World War II, as something that just isn't tenable, just not sellable to anybody.
Ian Lustig, I have to ask, though, because I'm sure many people are thinking, on 9/11, we saw, I don't know how to describe it, but it did not look like a success of containment and deterrence. It looked like a demonstration of vulnerability. This was one way of responding to that vulnerability. If this is wrong, if this is discredited, if it's headed toward the ashbin of history, and I'm waiting to see if that's true, but if it is, what's the replacement strategy for this country?
Well, we have to distinguish among enemies. Okay, Saddam was an enemy. He was an evil guy. And he had a small amount of power, nothing like what he was portrayed to have. But he was not as dangerous to us as we were to ourselves, wielding massive power irresponsibility. Irresponsibility linked to massive power is more dangerous than evil linked to a little power. Now, that's one point. The other point is we have to distinguish between enemies. When we fought the Soviet Union, we were fighting established state powers with governments that had things to lose. Though when governments have things to lose and leadership capacities, then you can threaten them, use what's called deterrence. If you do that, we will hurt you more than it's worth your doing it. Therefore, you won't do it. And deterrence worked.
You're fine, but we live in the briefcase bomb era now.
Well, that's right, but just a second. We were also deterred by the Soviets. But when you're dealing with terrorists who are representing a fantasy about the world, as Osama bin Laden does, wanting to use a struggle with the United States in order to transform the Muslim world, these people are not deterrable. You cannot deter those people. They're not Saddam. The war we fought in Afghanistan and the war we're fighting every day under the underground against Al-Qaeda and the networks that are associated with Al-Qaeda, that's a different sort of war. You don't use deterrence. You don't threaten.
In other words, you go after them.
You destroy capabilities. That's a different sort of war. And what we did by pretending that the war in Iraq was a war against terrorist capabilities when it was really an adventure serving a fantasy of a small group that was using the panic after 9/11, we have interrupted the real struggle. And I think this is one of the things that the elites in this country have got to teach the American people. They are living in a world where suitcase bombs are possible, but very unlikely. And yet the threat to American democracy from overreaction to them will more than anything serve the interests of our enemies. This is the war, a very difficult one, that we have to fight in a sophisticated way, not in a stupid John Wayne imitation in Iraq that actually hurts the real effort we ought to be pursuing. So deterrence is not the issue when it comes to Al-Qaeda. It was the issue when it comes to established governments, usually.
I want to try and squeeze in a couple of our good and patient callers. Rick is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Rick, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Reminds me of what Nelson Mandela said before the war started. He said, George Bush can't think right. And I think that that means that George Bush is not going to come up with an exit strategy that isn't ruthless in the way Bill Kristol spoke of it earlier. I think what we have to do is have a citizens' exit strategy, which would mean, one, vote for anybody but Bush in fall. Two, support soldiers who resist fighting there. And three, organize 1 million citizens to march on Washington in March or May of 2005.
There's a passion against this effort, and we hear it. Rick, thank you for your call. Irwin is calling from Groton, Connecticut. Hi, Irwin. You're on the air.
Hey, there, Ed. Thanks for taking my call. Man, yeah. I totally disagree with both of those announcements you made for the two gentlemen there. You cannot fight terrorists unless you can be one. And I don't know any American who wants to be a terrorist. Just like you can't catch a criminal if you're not a criminal. Just like if we can't put spies in there that can do the dirty work, you can never fight this war.
But police do catch criminals, and they're not criminals, Irwin.
You have undercover cops. I mean, you got people who are undercover in the mob.
But you've got to fight terrorists, right? If terrorists are really determined to blow up your cities, you have no choice but to fight that.
You're exactly right. You have to fight them, but you got to fight them the way they fight you. And it's hard to fight terrorists when you got one hand tied behind your back, and the media onslaught of all these media organizations are always. And it's disgusting to see the political pointing fingers and it's your fault. No, it's not my fault. We got to do something. We got solutions. It all hinders on one fact. We got troops over there fighting and these media war. You know, like for instance, Jordan just stopped a bomb plot with weapons of mass destruction, and there's no follow up on that. You know, you got these senators make open hearings about our troops that affect the troops in Iraq.
Irwin, I want to be sure I understand what you're saying. Are you saying let's put the hammer down, let's go an even harder than we have in Iraq? Would that fight terrorism?
I'm not saying drop a nuke bomb, but how do you fight a guy who wants to chop off your head? You know, how do you fight a person like that? I mean, do you wait in the United States until they come to you like they did in 9/11, or you try to find them where they are?
Irwin, we've got it. Our time is short. Let Ian Lustig pick it up. Dr. Lustig.
Yes, Irwin. Well, I think he's right. You don't fight terrorists the same way that you fight a state. That's why the whole idea of sending tanks and planes and armies to fight against people who attack on 9/11, that's just silly. You have to fight them smart. You have to fight them as undercover cops do. But that's not a heroic kind of fight. It's not the right kind of fight that we have there in Iraq. As far as the previous caller, we do need an exit strategy. The exit strategy, unfortunately, as I've been saying for the last year, the price of that exit goes up every single month. The price in terms of how much money we're going to have to pay the people that we convinced to take over, namely the Muslim countries and the European countries and the UN. We're going to have to pay for them to do it. We're going to have to pay a higher price in terms of transferring authority to them, in which our troops for a while will probably be taking orders from non-Americans. And number three, I think one of the prices for our exit will ultimately be a serious American effort to finally solve the Israeli-Palestinian situation. That's one of the ways, and probably if the United States just implemented its policy on this, official policy, a two-state solution, which we could actually achieve quite easily if we tried, that would be go a long way toward helping us get the kind of support in the Middle East that we're going to need to get out of Iraq. So those are the three things we're going to be paying in order to get out eventually. But I don't think this administration can do it because a fourth element is eating crow, literally eating crow. The American leadership must come forward and say, look, we made a big mistake. The United Nations, the world community was correct in suggesting that we not deal with Saddam the way we did. It's been done. Now we need the help of the international community and of Europe and of our friends to do at the best job we can against our enemies, including the terrorists throughout the world. Only a new administration, I fear, will be able to say that. And so I don't see an exit until there's a new administration.
Eating crow on the menu. What a week. It's bruising. Ian Lustig, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Ian Lustig, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Jack Beatty, well, we'll keep watching all this. I thank you for being with us on this night. Thanks for being with us, Jack.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.